So we'll take a moment to just first let our minds settle. It's very helpful to let our attention descend, sort of, so to speak, from our being caught up in thoughts and getting ready for the class and all of the things we've had to do today, and just let it settle into an awareness of our body. Starting from the top of the head, we can do a quick body scan. Just noticing how we feel. Any tension we can let go, but mostly it's just a question of placing our attention and becoming aware of what our body feels like. Starting with the top of the head. The back of the head. Just bringing attention to what it feels like. The face. The eyes, the nose. The mouth and tongue and jaw. The ears, down into the neck, the front of the neck, and the back of the neck, and down the back of the body, by the upper back, the shoulders, the middle back, the lower back, down the front of the body, the chest, the rib cage, the abdomen, down both arms simultaneously, from the shoulders to the upper arms, to the elbows, to the lower arms, the forearms, the wrists, the back of the hands and the front of the hands, the palm, and down each finger, the thumb, and each of the four fingers simultaneously. And we may notice our energy actually settling as we become aware of, you know, our body progressively. Our seat and feeling supported by the seat of the chair or the cushion that we're sitting on. Down both legs simultaneously from the hip joint into the thighs, the knees, the lower legs, both the calves and the shins. Into the ankles, down the sole of the foot, and down the top of the foot, into the toes, down all of the toes simultaneously, and really feeling our feet if we're sitting in a chair or in a car. We can notice our feet on the floor, supported by the floor, very stable posture. We can square our shoulders a little bit, bring our chin in just a tiny, almost imperceptible amount to let our neck straighten into a natural straightness. Hands in a stable position in the meditation mudra or on our thighs. Making sure that there's no tension in our jaw. And with our eyes either closed or slightly open, we go on to contemplate each of the four thoughts very briefly, the precious human existence, really feeling a sense of appreciation in our heart for this opportunity, this rare opportunity. In death and impermanence, that the opportunity won't last forever and we don't know when it will end, so we need to practice now. Then to the law of karma, cause and result, that what happens to us in the future depends on our actions now, whether they're actions of harm to others through body, speech, or mind that result in our future suffering, actions that are helpful to others that result in our future happiness, or practice that leads to liberation from samsara. It's all up to us. And then fourth, samsara, the reminder that through the three types of suffering, there is no space or moment in samsara that is free from suffering. So our goal as practitioners is to free ourselves from samsara, not simply from suffering, but from all of samsara, since even happiness is classed as suffering and leads to suffering. and we take a moment to empower our practice through asking for the blessing of our teacher or the Buddha, visualizing them on the top of our head, above the crown of our head, beaming upon us because they're so happy that we're undertaking this practice, and radiating love and compassion. And then we think that we've received their blessing, and they descend into our heart center, continuing to radiate light, love, and compassion without needing to think about that further or to hold on to that image. We just know that they're there. So with our practice less empowered by the four thoughts and the blessing of our teacher or the Buddha, we'll follow our breath for a couple of minutes, a minute to stabilize our awareness. If your mind is very scattered, you can count your breaths. Otherwise, we can just rest following our inhalations and exhalations. And you can let go of that if you don't need it and just rest in open awareness. And then we go through the sequence of ultimate bodhicitta cultivation that leads us to resting in the nature of our mind. First, letting the reality and solidity of our current experience sort of fade a bit, and regarding all our experience as a dream, meaning everything that we can perceive through our senses has a dreamlike quality, and everything that we're thinking and feeling internally also has a dreamlike quality, which could be as simple as just remembering its impermanence, that it's fleeting. Really letting ourselves relax into that dreamlike feeling. It's still happening, but we're just not giving it as much weight. And now turning our attention inward to look at the source of this perception of all our experience as a dream, looking directly at our own awareness, which is unborn. It has no beginning, it has no definable characteristics, so it's called unborn. And we can sort of bring our attention into slightly more focus by asking it a question or two. Does it have a shape, this awareness? Does it have a location? Does it come from somewhere? Does it go somewhere? Just asking the question and resting in what we see. And that is called the remedy, which is the remedy for seeing things as solid, including our own mind. And the third step is to let go even of the remedy, meaning to let go of all conceptuality and rest in the essence, the basis of everything, which Zhangbong Hongzhou says refers to our Buddha nature, the nature of mind, the nature of all phenomena. We're resting in that. And if thoughts come up, we simply let them dissolve. We don't make them dissolve, but we allow them to dissolve in their own time. We don't hold on to them or turn them into chains of conceptuality. So we'll rest like that for a moment. Another way to put that is to rest in the essence of whatever arises. Which means letting go of any sense of content or conceptuality and simply resting in awareness. And now within that awareness, without losing it, we will go on to cultivating relative bodhicitta, love and compassion, with the slogan. Forgetting how it's worded, but we're going to engage in taking and sending meditation, coordinating it with the breath. So we can start by just again focusing some of our attention on our breathing, our inhalations and exhalations, becoming very aware of them, the length of them, any pauses. That only takes up part of our attention though, and with the rest of it, we're still resting in open awareness, the nature of mind. And if it helps to make it more vivid, we can breathe in dark, smoky light and breathe out white light or multicolored light. Breathing in the dark light, we think that we're breathing in the suffering of all sentient beings. Breathing out the white or multicolored light, the refreshing light, we think we're breathing out happiness, relaxation, peace of mind, healing, whatever people need, beings need to relieve their suffering. All sentient beings, and if individuals come to mind, that's fine. You can also focus on them. And now I'm going to read verse 19, and we're going to use that for taking and sending. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich as Croesus, Oprah, Jeffrey Bezos. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we're going to think of, first of all, we're going to think of all that we have. All the riches that we have, whether it's money, maybe we don't have money, but we have health. Maybe we don't have health, but we have a house to live in. Maybe we have contentment, no matter what we have or don't have. So whatever happiness we have, and we can think of specific experiences of happiness in our lives, if that's helpful, in the past or the present. We're going to breathe in the suffering of beings and breathe out to them that happiness, that wealth we have, whatever positive experiences we have in our lives. We're going to coordinate that with our breath. Breathing in the suffering of all sentient beings of the six realms and all its variety. Breathing out to them everything positive that we have in our lives. Making it as vivid as possible. Again, if you're thinking of someone with specific suffering, specific people or animals or other beings, it's fine. Just always keeping the long view or the wide view of all sentient beings included in the picture. Whatever fear there is in the world, we breathe it in. Let it dissolve with our breath. Breathe out all the happiness and contentment that we have. Whatever pain and illness there is in the world, we breathe it in. Let it dissolve and breathe out all of our wealth and happiness. Now it springs to mind, someone could be an individual or it could just be sort of a category. All of the people in the world who have everything they could possibly want, materially speaking, all of the billionaires or any one billionaire, and bring them to mind and breathe in their suffering. Let it dissolve and breathe out to them whatever happiness and wealth we feel that we have. The commentaries say that people who have wealth and fame have suffering that goes along with that. So we'll breathe in whatever suffering they have. And breathe out the kind of happiness we have that they may not have. Giving it freely, without judgment. And we can also include all beings in that happiness. We can send it to homeless people and to everybody else. And now letting go of the thought of breathing and suffering, let's focus entirely on being aware of what wealth and contentment and happiness we have in our lives. And breathe that out to all sentient beings on each out-breath. You can even enumerate it, breathing out the ability to walk, breathing out the beautiful weather, breathing out whatever good food we've had lately, breathing out the feeling of being loved and having friends. Breathing out the ability to be content with whatever we have. And now we can think that all beings, including ourselves, are completely free from suffering, completely filled with every kind of wealth and happiness, and completely awakened. Rest in that for a moment. And now let go of all thoughts and concepts and go back to either following the breath or resting in open awareness. And now coming back to our class. Stretch or take a sip of water, whatever you need to sort of bring you back into a studying and contemplating frame of mind. So today, I'm gonna give the class a choice. Because of my cold, I do not feel up to leading, chanting all of the verses. If we really want to chant the verses today and someone else would like to step forward, I will unmute you and you can lead the chanting, or we can skip that part today and just chant verse 19. Anybody have an opinion on that? Everybody who would like to chant the verses and have someone else lead it, raise your hand. Everybody who would like to skip the chanting this week and go on to the teaching? All right, well, it looks like that one. but anyone can chant them on their own anytime. We are gonna chant the 19th verse though. And I'm gonna put that on the screen, and I'm giving us three different versions of it. So your job as participants in the class, you are now in the translator seat today, all of you. And we're gonna chant three different versions of this verse. And then we're going to talk about the translation process and which version we're more comfortable with. Because translators have, like free rein, you know, as long as we're faithful to the meaning, we do our best to convey it in the words that best convey it. So anyway, I'm going to put that on the screen. Screen share. Okay, I'm going to scroll down to verse 19. So the first version is the one that I have posted, and that's the version I'm working with right now. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame, and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich as Croesus, Oprah, Jeffrey Bezos. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success, and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame, and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success, and never think I'm better than the rest. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So before I stop the screen share and we go on to discussion, just to go over again the differences. So in the first, so the 19b, I'm rich as Vaishravana, god of wealth. That is the literal translation. It doesn't even say god of wealth in the Tibetan. It says Vaishravana because everybody knows who Vaishravana is. Nam Tibu in Tibetan. And that would have had a lot of resonance in Tibet. It's basically the equivalent of Zambala or Jambala, and those of us who've been around the Dharma for a while know that that is the god of wealth, and we do the Zambala practice and so forth. So that can be very meaningful. I went for examples that I felt resonated with us as North American Westerners of the 21st century. I'm rich as Croesus, and if you don't know who Croesus was, then we can talk about that, or you can read it on my post. I'm rich as Croesus, Oprah, Jeffrey Bezos. And when we think of them, we think of people who have like as much wealth as they could possibly want, like the wealthiest of the wealthy. And then in the third version, this one comes from Daedra, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. So that, there's no relation to the Tibetan at all, but it is the exact phrase that would resonate. You know, that's a phrase that we know, rich beyond my wildest dreams. I had to add the very for the meter. So I'm going to stop the screen share now. And we can start by talking about the translation for a minute, or if anybody has any other questions, you know, before we get started on the commentaries and the discussion of the meaning of the verse. So anybody have an opinion, anything they'd like to say about those three choices? Okay, Valerie, I'm gonna unmute you.
Are we like voting on this or something?
No, if you have any feedback, it's not a vote. Right now it's the way it is. I personally will probably go with a different version over time. Oh, I see Mark has his hand raised. So I'm going to unmute you, Mark.
Hi. I was just wondering if the Tibetan had anything to do with like being jealous of the like Croesus or
No. Nothing about jealousy. I mean, I don't think that really enters into it. It's you're rejoicing because you in the Tibetan you're thinking of the symbol, the best known symbol of wealth.
Okay.
In your culture, and that is the god of wealth, Vaishravana or Nam Tibu in Tibetan. So no sense of jealousy, although
you don't necessarily have to have that object.
I'm sorry, what?
You don't have to have an actual person object that you might be jealous of.
No. It's not a jealousy question at all. And maybe we are jealous of Oprah and Jeffrey Bezos. I don't know. Or Bezos. I think he says his name Bezos, really. But
yeah, okay.
Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Oh, Mark, were you not finished?
Yeah, since it's not, since there is nothing like that, I kind of go for the last one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And Dan is agreeing with that. So Dan, you're liking beyond my very wildest dreams. Yeah. Okay. I'm unmuting Kathy.
Yeah, I like either the second or the third one. The first one, you know, like Oprah, I know about her wealth. The other two, it's like, it has no meaning for me.
Right. Well, Croesus is actually, I mean, maybe, I don't know, some of us know and some of us don't. Rich's Croesus is like a metaphor that's quite often used. And I explained who he was in my class notes. He's right. Just ancient and foreign.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I've heard that before, but, you know, just personally, it doesn't.
You're saying it doesn't resonate with you.
No.
Yes. Anybody else have a thought on this? I'm going with Patrick.
I wonder about never think I'm better than the rest. Mm-hmm. Never think I'm different than the rest.
No. No, because different is a neutral term. Different could be good or bad. What it is it's not to be arrogant. I'm not arrogant about it. The literal Tibetan says it's kengme. Kengpa means to be sort of puffed up with yourself, sort of puffed up in thinking that you're better than others. Pema Chodron sort of gives it as condescending. It's usually translated as arrogant. But the dictionary that I use the most says it's really like not even arrogant, but just full of yourself, puffed up and, you know, by your success. But thanks for that contribution to the discussion. Okay, any other comments? Okay, Joanne.
I'm unmuted. All right. The first one seems most relevant. However, I also wonder why Bill Gates is in amongst those notary and those rich people.
I'm sorry, but I didn't hear what you said.
Bill Gates. Why Bill Gates?
Well, I started with Bill Gates. I said Bill Gates.
All right.
Croesus, Bill Gates.
Why I'm alluding
to. Then I thought, it's all guys.
And I'm sure the others have, but I think that with great wealth is great responsibility, and that aspect of being a humanitarian and a philanthropist, but at the same time remaining anonymous. If you certainly share your wealth, but do it anonymously, and do, I guess, the most compassionate, I would certainly include that in my sense of giving and generosity.
Right.
In the truest sense of the word.
Right. I very much appreciate the thought. It doesn't enter into the verse, though. Like, it's really just, you're just looking for a symbol of somebody who's very wealthy. But you're saying because Bill Gates is a great philanthropist, you'd rather see his name in there. If we were going to go, I probably, in the long term, I wouldn't go with this translation, but it was fun for me to think of it like that. Deidre, I'm wondering if you have anything to say since you came up with translation number 3.
Yeah, the names were just all stumbling blocks for me. Like whether it's the first or, I think in Kempo Sutrum Rinpoche's, he just says, you know, amass the riches of a god of wealth.
Right.
That kind of filled it for me.
Yeah.
I didn't have to go beyond that. And because I am currently living in a god realm, it's pretty easy. I got supports right out the window up the wazoo. So yeah. Maybe yeah. For me, it's a little easier.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was just, they felt like stumbling blocks.
Yeah, sure. They are hard names. It's also, go ahead.
Just because there isn't anything else like that in the whole rest of the practices.
Yeah.
It's all kind of more, there aren't any other pointed names in the whole rest of the 37 practices, but this one.
And so it's in the Tibetan, which is why I went with names. Yeah, because it's the Tibetan.
but I think in Tibet it was harder to imagine riches than it is in America.
Maybe so.
So they probably saw one person as like the rich, whereas here it's just like, turn on the TV.
Yeah.
They're all over.
I think that's why they went with, the god of wealth is the symbol of wealth, and everybody knows the god of wealth in Tibet. Like, it's just one of those things everybody knows. So yeah, I think Vaishravana, Tipton Shudran translated it quite literally. And she said, as rich as Vaishravana.
Yeah.
Which I think leaves us kind of really hanging. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I like the third translation, and it's not, you know, so what's happening here is I'm sort of giving you a little bit of a glimpse into the life of a translator. So we can go with literal Vaishravana, which is like, okay, it's another, it would be a stumbling block, whether we said Vaishravana or Namtabu. We could go with generic God of Wealth, as most of the translators did, that we use. But still, I feel like it's not that resonant for us, God. It means a lot in cultures that have a God of Wealth, but we don't have a God of Wealth. We have wealthy people who are like gods. So that was one way to translate it. But sometimes as a translator, I go, you know, I just find different words to reflect something that's not literal to the Tibetan, as I did, as Patrick's asking about. The literal Tibetan says, for that last line is without arrogance or without being full of myself. So I had to fill out the meter too, you know, to make it chantable. So I went with never think I'm better than the rest, which is a way of saying that, but it's not literal to them. So anyway, anybody have any other observations or thoughts about the translation? I just thought it would be interesting to share that with all of you. All right, then we will go on to, Valerie, you're unmuted.
Kind of another way to think about that I'm not better than anybody, could you say I'm more conscious than other people?
Conscious, so this is interesting. We are really getting into translation questions. It doesn't work. I see Marilyn, do you want to speak to that one? I just see you shaking your head. You don't have to.
It just seemed to me that what we're saying in the third, the second line of the third, I never think I'm better than the rest. We're saying something that's, negative on purpose. Never think I am. I mean, so that's good to keep in. But yeah. Not a very useful comment on my part.
Well, what I would say is conscious. It's very similar to what Patrick brought up. It's like, could we say, never think I'm different from the rest? Well, different is not a neutral term. And conscious, it doesn't have anything to do with having more wealth or fame. Doesn't make you more conscious, I don't think. What we're talking about is literally arrogance. And when whatever commentary you're using, like you can look at my translation, but you can also look at that translation and it will reinforce the meaning. So we're looking for a way to say, don't think that you're above other people just because you're wealthy or famous. But actually, Valerie, it's a really good point, and it's going to be brought out by a couple of our commenters, that in terms of having Dharma, like as Dharma people, we don't think that we're superior to other people. That's a big fault.
Well, also, I don't think people have money. And you look at somebody like Donald Trump, who's like a real example of like the last thing that you want to be in the universe, and he has money. You know, so I don't think he's better because he has money, is what I'm saying.
Right. I don't think Jeffrey Bezos is better either, even though he owns Amazon and the Washington Post. You know, doesn't make him a better person. But somebody like that could think that they're better.
I'm sure they do.
And we could fall into that trap too. And one of the ways we can fall into that trap, which is brought out in the commentaries, and as you also brought out a couple of weeks ago, is because we're Dharma practitioners. We have the precious human existence, and we have access to the teachings, and we've practiced, and all those other people out there have not. Like, they don't have a clue about their nature of mind. So we could think that makes us better than them. And that's one of the basic teachings, is not to ever think that you're better than other people because you meditate or because you're more in touch with your nature of mind. So there's a lot of ways that we could have pride over what we have, from money to fame to, you know, to being a Dharma practitioner, or, you know, I've been practicing the Dharma for 10 years as a, you know, or 20, I've been doing it for 20 years. Oh, I'm doing Vipassana, I'm not doing Shine, or I've done Mahamudra, you know, or, oh, I'm all those teachings, like, forget the preliminaries, I only do Dzogchen, you know, like, there's all kinds of little attitudes that we could fall into as Dharma practitioners.
Yes. So
the point of this is, like, whatever our good fortune is, we don't use it to build up our ego. So this is building up the ego, and that's what's called spiritual materialism. That's the whole point of, like, that was Trungpa Rinpoche's second book, I think, and his first one that really got a lot of attention, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, is about not using the Dharma to build up our ego, because the ego can turn anything to its advantage, and we always need to be vigilant. So this verse is about that somewhat, is about not using our good fortune, whatever it may be, in the service of our ego. So anybody have anything else before we turn to the commentaries? Sorry, pencil. All right, so we have some good ones. We're going to look first actually at Pema Chidren today, because we don't often get to look at her. She skips verses sometimes, but she did verse 19. Again, this was a teaching weekend on the 37 practices and 26 at Omega Institute, which is up close to the monastery. Lama Daipa teaches meditation there every year to the residents at Omega. She goes for a week a couple of times a year and does meditation classes for the residents at Omega. So what Pema Chidren has to say about verse 19, and it's all very short because she only had 2 days to do the whole text, three sessions. She says, positive obstacles. This verse is about positive obstacles. The other one was like, everything is going wrong, right? I'm sick, I don't have any money, everybody hates me, and I'm mentally ill too, like my mind is just like a mess, I'm, you know, have no control over my mind. Well, this is the positive stuff. It's like, I'm so rich. And I'm so famous, more famous than anybody. And I have a precious human existence. So she says, positive obstacles. Raise your hand if you're having these. Which got a big laugh from people. First of all, we don't, most of us, think that we're wealthy or famous. Famous, definitely. But, you know, I mean, we could realize that we're pretty wealthy compared to people in other situations sometimes. But we don't tend to focus on our good fortune as much as our bad fortune, I think. So we don't tend to think that what we are experiencing is good fortune so much. But we also, if we do have it, we don't think of it as an obstacle. And that's what this verse is pointing out to us, is beware of good fortune, beware of money, beware of fame, beware of pride. Those are really big stumbling blocks on the path of awakening, and Ken McLeod is going to bring that out in a very nice way. But she says, positive obstacles, raise your hand if you're having these. Then the question is, if you do have them, how to work with that as the path of awakening? How do we work with positive obstacles, with having too much good fortune? Bottom line is not to let it lull you into staying in your comfort zone and thinking it doesn't matter about other people. You know, you have enough of everything to just be cozy in your little life. And so you don't have to think about other people who are, you know, suffering or whatever. I'm sure none of us would do that anyway, but that's her advice, is don't let that happen. She says, instead, use that good fortune as the basis for helping other people, for looking out and helping others in less fortunate situations, which is very similar. It's the same thing, basically, right, that Dingo Chense Rinpoche said. Yes, sounds like the God realm, says Mark. Yes, it is the God realm. Having everything that you could buy. I mean, you know, Oprah and, you know, Bill Gates and Jeffrey Bezos and all of the rich people. It's like being in the God's realm in a material way. Doesn't mean they don't have suffering. In the God's realms, you don't even have suffering. But yes, it's very much like the God's realm, fame and fortune. So it's very much the same what she's saying here, using the good fortune as a basis for helping other people. It's the same thing that Dingo Chense said in the commentary for verse 18, the previous verse where everything is going wrong, when everything is going wrong for yourself, then one way that we, one antidote to sort of getting sucked into a negative frame of mind about that is use whatever you do have to help other people. Like realize that other people have it as bad as you, have it worse than you. You're not the only one who's suffering. So we look around for ways that we can help people. And so here we have good fortune. You know, people who have wealth, it's very obvious how they can help people. You know, they can give money to, as Joanne was talking about, like Bill Gates does a lot of philanthropy. Famous people have a platform for better and for worse. You know, I mean, they can give money, but they can also draw attention to things that are happening to people. So, and she says, and so we do that without condescension. That's that Tibetan word kenge, without getting puffed up in any way, without thinking we're better than other people. We do it without condescension. And what helps us do it without condescension is because we have experienced pain ourselves. And we know that we can lose our fame or fortune because we are practitioners. So we know this, but like really anybody knows. I guess maybe somebody was born into wealth and fame. Maybe they don't know yet. But because we know that it's fleeting, wealth and fame could be taken away from us at any moment. And because we know what it's like to suffer, to not have wealth, to not have fame, then if we happen to find those things, that helps us not think we're better than other people for it. Because we've also had pain and also knowing we can lose our fame or wealth, that these are very transitory things. And that's a point that's brought out again and again in all the commentaries. It doesn't last. You can't count on it. And even if you have it, you can't count on it lasting. So she says, knowing that, rather than letting it make you dig your heels in more and ignore other people, you open your heart and you reach out to them based on all of this bounty that you have. She says, positive circumstances of any kind. So we could take even a small positive circumstance. And she says, even a spring weekend retreat at Omega with no allergies. We can use these positive aspects of our life as an out-breath, wishing for others to have it. So that's a reminder that we don't have to do, like, taking and sending doesn't have to be the whole thing. It doesn't have to have somebody suffering for us to do taking and sending. We can send out whatever good fortune and happiness we have at any moment. We see a beautiful sunset. We could remember to breathe it out. May all beings enjoy a beautiful sunset. You know, may all beings win, if we were to win the lottery, you might think, may all beings win the lottery. I wouldn't necessarily wish that on anyone, but it does feel like good fortune, I think, if it happens. So that's Pema Chodron's take. We're going to now go to Dingo Chense Rinpoche. And he and Geshe Jompa Tetchup both have very short commentaries on this verse. Probably not the biggest, this is not the obstacle most likely for people to have on the path of Dharma is being too rich and too famous. And here he says, his translation is, though I may be famous and revered by many and as rich as the God of wealth himself, to see the wealth and glory of the world are without essence and to be free of arrogance is the practice of a bodhisattva. So he starts out, I'm not going to read the whole thing. He starts out by pointing out that a bodhisattva sees that whatever fortunate circumstances we may have, wealth, beauty, influence, prosperity, a good family, they're all as fleeting as a flash of lightning, as ephemeral as a dewdrop, as hollow as a bubble. That verse, the Buddha taught on impermanence. Just remember that everything is like that. And he says he is never conceited or proud, no matter what worldly achievements and privileges may come to him or her. And then in the next paragraph, whatever we have, it's going to be taken away anyway eventually. You know, somebody will steal it. Wealth, like somebody can always steal it. Fame, you could always screw up and suddenly everybody hates you. And then if nothing else takes it away, then you die and you can't take it with you and it only causes problems for your heirs. So the part that I'm going to read is Vian's Jetson Milarepa. Always taught his lay disciples that the best way for them to accomplish the Dharma, let's think about what that could be. What is the best way for them to accomplish the Dharma? Think six paramitas was to be generous to those in need. Even a small act of generosity done with an altruistic mind accumulates great merit. And when we study the six paramitas, as we are doing in Washington, D.C., we realize that there's the benefit. Like, so it's generosity, for example, is like a perfect dharmic act. Oh, I like your toy there, Dan. perfect act. You get the immediate benefit of helping someone else, which has a very good feeling attached to it. You also get the merit of it, and you also get an opportunity to realize wisdom, which makes it a paramita. So it's like a whole Dharma practice. So Milarepa said that the best way to practice the Dharma or to accomplish the Dharma was to be generous to those in need, because we earn merit through it. He says, if you have power and wealth, make it meaningful. Use it for the sake of the Dharma and to benefit beings. So we can, you know, we can make offerings, which is said to be very meritorious. We can help the poor, whoever needs what we have. And he says, on the other hand, if you hold on to your wealth, then you're sowing the seed of rebirth among the tortured spirits, also known as the hungry ghosts, who are deprived of everything. So it's to our benefit. It's always, that's a beautiful thing about Dharma. It's always to our benefit, even though the method of Dharma is team other. Always think of the other person's benefit. By thinking of the other person's benefit, we always benefit ourselves. So, and then by being selfish, we're hurting ourselves. By only allowing ourselves to enjoy our good fortune, we end up in the hungry ghost realm. So he says we should pray to be able to follow the example of the great bodhisattvas, who because of their past generosity and accumulated merit, were born as powerful monarchs with fabulous wealth. So that's one thing that generosity can get you in the long term, is rebirth as someone with a lot of wealth and power. And they use their riches to help the poor and to alleviate famine and sickness. And here's the important point, in addition to caring for the physical welfare of their people, these monarchs, these Chakravartins, they taught them to avoid the 10 negative actions and to perform the 10 positive ones. So if you've studied the six paramitas and studied the paramita of generosity, you know that it has three parts. There's three specific kinds of generosity that we are encouraged to practice. And the first one is material generosity, which is really obvious. The second one is called the generosity of fearlessness, giving fearlessness, which we've talked about a lot, and it seems to mean whatever support we can give to people, like emotional support, like helping people have less fear of their circumstances. You know, if someone's sick, then they know someone's taking care of them. Someone cares about them. That's giving fearlessness, if we support them more emotionally. And then the third kind is giving the Dharma, which is considered actually the most important kind of generosity. And so that's what he's saying that these kings do. And so silent pop quiz, we haven't done one of those in a long time. So giving them the Dharma, they taught them to avoid the 10 negative actions. So I'm going to put on the Jeopardy music, and let's see if we can just to ourselves think of what those 10 negative actions are. 3 of body, 4 of speech, and 3 of mind. We're not going to say what they are. So however many you were able to reel off in your head, that's really good. That's what I do whenever I run across these things. Like, do I know that list? Because the more you have it internalized, the more useful it is. All right, so he says, we should think, may the needs of all beings, even the smallest insect, to be fulfilled. Use your wealth and possessions in the best possible way to help others. Whenever possible, try to provide others with their everyday needs of food, clothing, shelter, and so on. And that's what he talked about in verse 18 too. Whether we're filled with good fortune or whether we're filled with bad fortune, the advice is the same. Help other people. Help them have food, help them have clothing, shelter, and he mentioned affection in the other one. At the same time, make the wish to be able to fulfill their ultimate needs by giving them the sublime gift of the Dharma. So we are also going to look at Kempo Tsultum Jangso Rinpoche's book, which I know many of us, that was the first, our first encounter with the 37 practices. He taught it at KTC many, many years ago. And he had the book, which I think is now out of print. So this is his commentary, Kempo Tsultum Jangso Rinpoche. He says, and this was like before the age of Twitter and Facebook, today, when did he write? He wrote this in like, this was from the early 90s. Today, newspapers, radio, and television can instantly make someone world famous. In earlier times, fame was confined to a person's immediate vicinity. But whether on a broad or narrow scale, fame is impermanent. It changes, it vanishes. Therefore, Tokme says, that's Tokme Zanpo, says fame has no essence. So if we remember back to the verse, to see that there is no essence in success, and never think I'm better than the rest, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So the practice of a bodhisattva is to see that there's no essence in success. So what does that mean? We use the word essence a lot in Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism. So he says it has no essence because it's impermanent. It changes. It's just gone in a flash. That's what no essence means in this context. So you could also say just to remember that it's impermanent. It's just a fleeting and permanent thing. Did anybody have, I saw a couple of hands moving. Did anybody have anything they wanted to say? No. Okay. Oh, yes, Kathy. You're unmuted.
Okay. It's kind of interesting. I was just looking ahead here, and he talks about Vaishravana, the god of wealth, who is purported to be very rich and who protects the riches of others, right, which, you know, we have a lot of that going on.
What do you mean? Are you talking politics now?
Well, you know, the rich are protecting the rich.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Is that what it means?
No, no. And we're gonna get to that. That's the next line. Okay. That's the next. And that's good. Thanks for bringing that up and that question. Vaishravana is the god of wealth. We could think of him. We could substitute Zambala. Do you know Zambala? Well, that's an empowerment that we've gotten in the past and so forth. Zambal, it's like you get the Zambal empowerment and it helps you have prosperity. So Vaishravana is the god of wealth. He's actually one of the four great kings of the four directions, one of the great, you know, formulations in Tibetan Buddhism. He's the king of the north. So his job, the four great kings protect beings, and in particular, they protect Dharma practitioners, but they protect beings. So as the god of wealth, Vaishravana helps people have what they need. I don't think he's so much interested in people being billionaires, you know, because this comes out of a culture of, as somebody pointed out, mostly poverty. So he's a good guy, Vaishravana, not like billionaires who are helping other billionaires be billionaires at the expense of people who have nothing. So the text refers here to Vaishravana, the god of wealth, who is purported to be very rich and who protects the riches of others. But even wealth like Vaishravana's lacks essence, meaning it's impermanent. Especially these days, people are judged by how much they possess. And here's another point. Not only is their wealth impermanent, but it causes them suffering. He says, yet the rich are not happy. Wealth is impermanent and subject to change. Even though the nature of riches is impermanent and without essence, the wealthy strive to maintain and perpetuate their fortunes, and so they suffer. And that's something that we've heard about from our teachers, is that having a lot is also great suffering. Because once you have, then you have to protect what you have, and you always live in fear that it's going to be taken away. So that's a thing to remember about the billionaires who protect billionaires, is that their lives are filled with suffering. They're not happy people. You look like you have something to say, Kathy, do you? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right. So wealth is impermanent and wealth brings suffering with it. So these are things to keep in mind when we have, should we have wealth. It's not reliable. And it's also a cause of suffering. So give it all away. Or use it for good, like Bill Gates. So while the rich suffer from fear of poverty, the famous suffer from fear of becoming has-beens. And we've seen a lot of that happening lately in the news. Quite a lot of very famous people who have always had everything go exactly the way they want are suddenly like pariahs and not having anything, like don't have a job anymore, like their TV show is going on without them. It happened in a flash. I mean, still reeling. I read some of these newspaper accounts and some of them are still reeling. It's like, where did my life go? I had it for 20 years. Like, where did it go? So we've seen that very dramatically in the last few months, sudden loss of fame, or fame turning to, in the eight worldly concerns, the opposite of fame is disgrace. You're famous, you're on top of the world, you're like a renowned actor, people pay billions to have you in their movie, and then suddenly nobody wants to talk to you ever again. So that's disgrace. And if you happen to be subject to the eight worldly concerns, it feels really terrible. So Kempo Sultram Jamsa goes on to say, while the rich suffer from fear of poverty, the famous suffer from fear of becoming has-beens. Both experience suffering while still wealthy and famous because they do not realize that wealth and fame are groundless, impermanent, and empty of true essence. So we can't get puffed up about it, but as Dharma practitioners, we have an advantage here. Like, should we win the lottery, we know, A, it's going to bring suffering with it. It's not going to be like all a picnic. And second, it may not last. We may not be able to hold on to it. And people can, I mean, I had this on a small scale many, many years ago, back in the early 80s in New York City. We won like a newspaper game, $20,000. Several other people won at the same time, so it wasn't $20,000. It ended up being like $5,000 or something. But boy, did our friends want a piece of that. Suddenly, like everybody needed $1,000 for this or $1,000 for that. And we didn't have it. It was really ironic that we won this money because we were both independent contractors, like freelance workers, and we had not kept up that year, that one year. We didn't keep up with our estimated taxes and we owed like $2,000 or something. Like, where are we gonna get this money? And we won this game. It was just a newspaper thing. Like, if you get the right numbers, you got it. And suddenly it was in our laps, but like half of those $5,000 goes to taxes, right? So you've got just enough left over to pay your back taxes and maybe you have $1,000 left over, but that buys your husband a new computer, which he's been, you know, wanting for a long time. So our friends were mad at us because we won money. So it's all suffering. Just forget it. Don't want to be rich. Don't win the lottery. So he ends by saying the 7 points of mind training devotes a full chapter to impermanence. I will not say much about this here because it is a directly observable phenomenon. I just really liked that line. He doesn't have to tell us about impermanence because we can see it. He says, simply watch the news on television to see how quickly fame and notoriety fade, how the rich lose their wealth and the poor become rich. We'd like to see that happen, the poor becoming rich. I suppose we must see that sometimes. People do win the lottery. All right, so that's Pema Chidren and Dingo Chense and Kempo Sultram Jamsa Rinpoche and now Daedra.
I was just reading the last paragraph of that commentary, and he talks about like now people can die in the sky, whereas before people never did die in the sky because of the airplane crash. And he talks about also accelerated impermanence. Right. Which I thought was interesting,
right.
But just the idea that that just by saying that people can die in the sky, whereas before they never could, like we always think there's some way we can ensure our wealth and cheat impermanence somehow.
Yeah, we do think that. Know?
We do, but then we don't take into account that there's things outside of our knowledge now that will be a cause of our suffering in the future,
yeah.
Like these people.
Like what? Like
you like the people airplane? Died in a plane crash, yeah. In the middle of the year. You don't think that's going to happen 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yes, who knows? Like 100, I mean, I won't be alive 100 years from now. I guess probably most of us won't be. But I guess Clementine has a chance. She would be good. Yes. So yeah, I didn't read that paragraph, but he talked about how impermanence is accelerating through technology.
Right.
Yes. Tibetans could never have imagined somebody like hundreds of people dying at a time in a plane crash, like, or hundreds of people dying at a time in anything except maybe an avalanche. I guess that could happen. So it's a big, even a bigger scale now. And like with Twitter, as he pointed out at the beginning, with newspapers and so forth, like fame can happen really suddenly, and fame can be taken away really suddenly. People can love you suddenly, like the whole world, and then people can hate you suddenly, the whole world. It's a vast scale now. So I have two commentaries left. I'm going to read just a tiny little bit from Transforming the Heart by Geshe Jompa Tegchuk, and then we're going to do a meditation from Ken MacLeod, which brings in a whole different dimension than anybody else brought in. So what Geshe Jompa Tegchuk says, oh, that's verse 18, no wonder it doesn't seem to make sense. He says, Nagarjuna, now he's a Galugpa, so he's going to be citing teachers like Nagarjuna, who's like a Galugpa, you know, forefather. He says, Nagarjuna, but Kagyu lineage also highly respects Nagarjuna, and we quote him, and Kenpo Tsultram Rinpoche, you know, wrote books based on his, you know, gave teachings based on his books. He says, Nagarjuna cautioned us against feeling smug and proud due to our wealth or even due to the Dharma practice we have done. So he really brings this in strongly, the very point that Valerie was bringing up a couple of weeks ago. We may think we are special because of having done retreat, taken certain empowerments, or maybe because we know some excellent teachers, like I'm a student of Situ Rinpoche. In our arrogance, we tend to put others down and become reckless. Having become careless, we do many negative actions which will bring suffering in future lives. So pride gets us into trouble. We will have a lower position in society and be subjected to scorn. Therefore, whatever marvels we may come to possess, we should not feel superior but think, may all sentient beings have happiness like this, and we should respect those who currently lack these things. And I was thinking, like, when he was talking about, you know, how we become reckless and we put others down in our, you know, pride over being Dharma practitioners. I mean, most of us don't do that, but I have known Dharma practitioners, especially newer ones, who are so eager to go out there and demolish Christianity, like, you know, debate with Christians and show them how their religion is all wrong, or any other religion. And that's not how we use the Dharma. So that's the kind of thing that could be pride. It's like, now you think you think Buddhism is better than Christianity, so you can set everybody straight who's not a Buddhist yet. Mm-hmm. So last thing then is, anybody have anything to say before we do the meditation with Ken? Yes, Joanne.
What's the title of the text you just were reading from?
It's called Transforming the Heart.
All right.
If you need another commentary, I happen to really like this one.
And the author, is that Hema?
Geshe Jompa Tegchuk.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, he's a very well-known, he's no longer with us, he died in the 80s, but he's a very well-known Galugpa teacher. Right. And we don't often use Galugpa books in the Kagyu lineage, but I think this is just a fabulous commentary.
Okay, and just bring down that title again. I just need, all right, thank you very much, Lama.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, so Ken's, I'm going to read a little bit of what Ken has to say, and then he's going to do a very lovely meditation with us, which takes us, uses this verse to go really deeply into nature of mind. So his translation is, even when you are famous, honored by all, and as rich as the god of wealth himself, know that success in the world is ephemeral. So he skips all that no essence stuff and just goes straight to the definition. It's ephemeral. And don't let it go to your head. So he, too, is like picking an English phrase that's not literal to the Tibetan. Tibetan is just unconceited. Don't let it go to your head. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. He says, according to Nietzsche, the German philosopher, I love, you know, when, I have to plug in my computer. John, I forgot to plug it in at the beginning. My apologies. Okay. I love when, like, Western philosophers and so forth are brought into the discussion. According to Nietzsche, what does not kill you strengthens you. We all know that one. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. He says, it is true. Adversity does wake you up. I mean, you have to deal with it, right? And it wakes you up. Like, you think your life is just perfect and going, you're kind of lulling yourself. Like, oh, my life is so great. I don't even have to think about it. And then wham, something terrible happens. And it brings you back like, oh, my God, samsara. Of course, I was in samsara this whole time, but I forgot. But he says, good fortune can put you to sleep. Adversity wakes you up. Good fortune can put you to sleep. Your life becomes easier. Your survival is not threatened. Your immediate needs are met. You relax. You're in a good position, a good position for habitual patterns to assert themselves. I mean, that's what Mark was suggesting, that it's like the God's realm. And it is. In the God's realm, there's no need to wake up. The dream is perfect. Why wake up? And we can be on the smaller scale the same. Why wake up? Why do we need to practice? Everything's great. So he says, so I'm skipping a bunch here because we don't have a lot of time, but he says, he brings up another point. Like, and this is speaking to the arrogance, like thinking we're better than the rest, the arrogance thing. He says, why do you take credit for your good fortune? Much of it is a matter of pure luck. Where you were born, who your parents are, and the opportunities you have or do not have in your life, most of it is just luck. Now we would, and he knows this, would call it karma, but it's not based, the point is not based on our efforts in this lifetime or our worthiness in this lifetime necessarily. You exercise regularly and watch your diet, but your health depends just as much on your genes. Why do you take all the credit? You have a great job. Did you earn it, or did you happen to be in the right place at the right time? And if you win the lottery, why do you secretly congratulate yourself on picking those numbers? It reminds me of when I was raising my only child, who was a very challenging child to raise. I knew many other parents, and it was really funny. Like, parents of only children tended to take the credit. Like, if their kid didn't have stranger anxiety, they would say, oh, it's because I always introduced her to lots of people. Like, my kid had terrible stranger anxiety. So they always thought it was something they did. Like, anybody with two children knows better, right, Joanne? If you have two children, you know it's not what you did, because they can turn out so completely different. And that's like, it's a warning to you, Dan. They may not all be as perfect as Clementine. I don't think you heard that. All right, so good fortune is something that's somewhat like beyond our control. And then he says, if you take credit for all the good things in your life, like that your kid is perfect, why do you not take equal credit for the accidents and mistakes? So we're very quick to think it's bad luck when something bad happens, but when something good happens, we think we did it. So I'm going to skip lots of things here and go straight to, and I don't have the page number if anybody's looking. I was page 96 in my Kindle version. we're going to go straight to a meditation. He says, from time to time, so when we're experiencing good fortune, from time, and we can do this with bad fortune too, do it with any experience, but he's specifically saying this is one way to help ourselves wake up when we're enjoying a relatively trouble-free, stress-free period of our life. From time to time, ask, who experiences this good fortune? Who's having this good fortune? Who's feeling happy? That is Vipassana meditation. When we start looking at the nature of mind, and the way that we're looking at the nature of mind here is like one of the methods of Vipassana meditation is to ask who. Like, you hear a sound, will you look for the place in your mind that you're hearing that sound? Who's hearing the sound? Or if you're angry, like, who's angry? Who's feeling this anger? And you can't find it. Like, you can think, you can feel that it's there, like this observer, this little person in your mind, the mini me, but you can't really find it. And that's Vipassana, is when you recognize that, like, it feels like there's somebody up here who's experiencing this thing, and you turn your attention in and you look and you go, okay, who is that? Where is that located? What color is it? What shape is it? And these are methods that we're all pretty familiar with by now, I think. Hi, Clementine. So he says, as soon as you pose this question, something shifts. So let's do it. Let's get into a meditative mode a little bit, adjust our posture, and bring our attention into the present moment. And straight to looking, like, let's follow the breath for a minute, just to bring our attention into one place. And then within this relative state of Shine meditation, because we always start Vipassana meditation with Shina. You always bring your mind to rest first, either through open awareness, breathing, sensory perception. So now let's ask ourselves, who is experiencing this? Let's think of something good in our lives. Who is experiencing this good fortune? And let's just look. And I'm going to read Ken's words as we're looking. As soon as you pose this question, who's experiencing this good fortune? Or even who's experiencing this present moment? Something shifts. Whether your body was relaxed or agitated, it settles in a different way as soon as you turn your attention inward and look for who's having this experience. It settles. Whatever emotions you were feeling lose their hold, as do the stories. So those are just observations about how our mind may settle when we look inward at who's experiencing this. And he says, look and look again at what it is that experiences good fortune. Do not try to figure it out, just look. So let's do that. So the way we're going to do that, this is classic Vipassana meditation within Shina. Look and see who's experiencing this present moment. And you just ask the question, you look, and then you rest. And you rest for a while in just open awareness. And then you ask it again. Okay, who is it? Who is experiencing this present moment? And then you rest. And you look again, where is that experiencer located? And you rest. So it's not a continual search, but you just ask the question, you take a quick look, and then you rest. So let's look one more time. Who is it that's experiencing this present moment? Where are they located? And he says, at some point, you see that there is nothing there, just the experience of good fortune or the present moment and an awareness that knows it. The two are not different, yet not the same. All right, so I'm going to just read that again as we sit looking at who's experiencing this present moment. At some point, you see that there is nothing there, just the experience and an awareness that knows it. So let's rest like that for a moment. Just knowing that, but we're not thinking about it. We just had that drop into our mind. There's nothing there, just the experience and an awareness that knows it. And let's just rest in that. Not thinking, but just looking and resting in what we're experiencing, having asked the question. And then he says, and we're still looking, and then he says, the two are not different. The experience and the awareness are not different, yet they are not the same. We might have to have him have a talk with Rini Tolkien. And he says, rest right there in this knowledge. Like, so what we're going for in Vipassana, and I don't want to make it a goal, is a, sort of a non-dual experience. Because, right, that's what ignorance is experiencing the world in a dualistic way. So when we look directly at the mind and we question who's there, we're experiencing it at first as a dualistic thing, like there's somebody watching, somebody experiencing this experience. And so we let ourselves look, we let ourselves see that there's nobody there. We can't find anybody. And then we rest in the understanding that the experiencer and the experience are not really different from each other. But in the resting, we just rest. We're not rehashing like that thought. We've just allowed ourselves to touch upon the thought, and then we rest however it is. It's helping us demolish that false sense of duality. But it has to happen on its own time. So we just look and let it go. So that's how you look at the mind that's experiencing good fortune. And he says, now look at the good fortune itself. And this is also meditation. So think of something that is in your life that is good fortune. even if it's only having a roof over your head. So let's look at that good fortune. Look at the good fortune itself. What is it? If you look deeply, you see that success and good fortune are not solid entities. So the good fortune, like the, you know, having beautiful weather today, where is that located? The experience of good weather, or the good weather itself, or, you know, having a wonderful job or a wonderful significant other. Does it have a shape? Does it have a color? So through this looking, this act of looking, we see that it's not a solid thing that we can wrap our minds around. They are experiences that, like adversity and difficulty, arise and disappear in a nameless, ineffable, meaning there's no words to describe it, awareness. An awareness that has nothing to do with success and failure, prosperity or poverty, good fortune or bad. It's very similar to the way that we've been instructed many times to meditate by Lama Narla Rinpoche and other teachers, that we, when we find ourselves in an experience of anger, rest in that and look at it, like, who's experiencing this anger? And what is the anger? Does it have a shape? Does it have a color? Does it have any characteristic? Is it located somewhere? And then when we're experiencing happiness, we look the same way. And we find that there's some common ground there between a feeling of anger and a feeling of happiness. So here, bad fortune, good fortune, we look at who's experiencing it, and we let it go, and it relaxes the mind in such a way that we're able to more clearly see the non-dual nature of mind. But if we try to force it, then it just becomes a concept, and so we have to keep sitting and just resting with it. So we got a little Vipassana lesson, or Laktong lesson, insight lesson from Ken MacLeod. And he ends the chapter by saying, feelings of excitement and being special in the meditation, like if you're experiencing good fortune, you could do this. And feelings of excitement and being special give way to a well of quiet joy and deep appreciation. If you nurture that joy and appreciation, your good fortune cannot lull you into the sleep of inattention, complacency, and pride. So we've been told by all of the teachers, don't be proud of it. Don't be arrogant about it. Don't think you're better than people who don't have what you have. But Ken is saying, like, feel joy. You can feel joy about it. You can feel appreciation for it. It's a good way to bring appreciation and gratitude into your heart, which are very positive, nurturing emotions. And we can also use our good fortune to help others. And we can also use our good fortune as a basis of taking and sending. And we can also use our good fortune as a way of looking at our mind. Everything becomes like filled with Dharma in our lives if we use them in these ways. So does anybody have any final questions or comments before we do our prayers? Yes, John, I'm muting.
Yeah, yes. I'd just like to share something, because this morning before we came on, I went to run a few errands, had to go to the bank and quickly at the store, come here. So this applies because, you know, there's the pride and arrogance, and they're at the top of that what do you call it, list. So below that would be just a positive experience, right? So you're taking this positive experience, and today, in my case, it was the fact that I got into the bank and didn't even have to go through the little rope thing, and got to the teller and did my thing and was done. And as I was leaving, I was able to see my thoughts, and the thought was like, wow, that was quick. And then the next thought was, but don't, you know, it's not, you know, not that it's not permanent, but don't get used to it, because it's, you know, it's just not going to happen all the time.
Yeah.
Thinking, well, why is it only these positive ones that we blow off and say, all right, well, it's okay, but the negative ones we'll hold on to like but these other ones we can sort of deal with a little easier. But, and I'm glad that this the meditation you did, you know, if I had that this before that, it would have come in extra handy today.
Yeah, we can apply it to everything once we have it. Yes, thanks. That was great that you recognized that. Like, don't get used to it. Yes, Marilyn, I'm unmuting you. Okay.
just quickly, I was reading this when I was getting my car washed at the car wash, and I usually leave a $20 tip when the weather's really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that, you know, like Marilyn, you're not that rich that you're leaving a $20 tip, and then I'm reading this and going, go ahead, go leave it.
Yes, yes.
People like those people washing the cars in the cold weather. So it came right in handy.
Yes, wonderful. These are very inspiring words of wisdom that we're getting through these commentaries. And I just want to add that I think over-tipping is like one of the great pleasures of life. Just you make such a difference. 25% instead of 20%, and you've made somebody really ecstatic. Or $20 instead of, you know, whatever pittance someone else might leave. You just made somebody's week, probably. So I like to do that, too. You know, and it doesn't take a lot of money to be able to do that. Anybody else? Okay, I don't see anybody. So we're going to do the prayers, and then we'll talk for 1 minute or less about the Monday meditation class, and I will send an email about that anyway. All right, so in gratitude for the opportunity to have the good fortune of this study, contemplation, and meditation, we will dedicate to all sentient beings, may they have the same, and plus all wealth and prosperity and fame that, you know, would help them to. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, and from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, to train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. We'll bring our minds to rest just for a moment. Again, in our body, feeling what this present moment of awareness is like. And asking who's experiencing it. And resting in that. And now we'll come back because we're over time now, and I will unmute everybody.